Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have someone well known, I imagine, to many of our listeners and First Things readers, Heather McDonald, who is the Thomas Smith Fellow at the Manhattan Institute. She's a contributing editor at City Journal. She writes often. People have read her frequently in the Wall Street Journal, on the op-ed page. She's been writing at the LA Times, the Weekly Standard, for many years. She actually is one of the most prominent public intellectual commentators in the country. I would say actually for a good 20 years now. She's the author of many books. The one a couple of years ago was The War on Cops, which was 2016, and that climbed the publishing lists pretty nicely. And then most recently, which will be the topic for today, The Diversity Delusion, subtitled How Race and Gender Pandering Corrupt the University and Undermine Our Culture. Welcome, Heather.
Thank you so much, Mark, and it's such a privilege being with First Things again.
Thank you. Well, we'll go ahead and jump right in. The title, The Diversity Delusion. We know what diversity is. What is the diversity delusion?
The delusion is the idea that race and gender are the most important things about the self, that discrimination based on those traits is pervasive and endemic in American culture, and that therefore any disparity in representation in an institution which does not have, say, 50-50 males and females, or exact proportional representation of blacks and Hispanics, must therefore, by definition, be the result of racism and sexism.
So once you set human beings up in this way, as if their skin color and their sex, actually you put it this way, when you talk about, in the first chapter of the book, a charged set of ideas, premises that skin color, sex, and sexual preference are definitive of what we are as human beings. Once you begin there, then you sort of have to say, if we've got in STEM, if we've got, you know, 65%, 35% male, female, then something real fundamental is determining that. Their, again, deep identity, and that is just then by definition, there's a crime.
Well, it's an utterly inconsistent, illogical, hypocritical, and counterfactual ideology, because on the one hand, at various moments, the diversity ideologues play a race and gender essentialism card and say that these are essential characteristics that define worldview, you know, capacities to a certain extent. And at the other side, the other moment, they're saying these are all social constructs. So, you know, anybody who would dare to argue that there are racial differences, say, is going to be defined as a bigot. So they can't get their story straight and would argue on the one hand that males and females are identical and that there are no differences in risk tolerance, appetite for competition, levels of aggression, and certainly academic skills. And at the same time, they claim that all these differences are completely voluntary and up for grabs. So it's an incoherent ideology.
It is incoherent conceptually. It's incoherent in terms of empirical research, but it certainly is very effective, pragmatically, institutionally. I mean, it's almost as if the inconsistencies, you know, who cares if we're inconsistent? Who cares if we're saying that here we're for this and here we're against it? And if there's no one around to challenge, if the dogma of diversity, if the delusions of diversity are so firmly implanted than the expose of contradiction or of double dealing. It doesn't seem to, it never seems to curb the momentum toward the diversity delusion. I mean, Heather, in the last 20 years, it's gotten stronger, right?
Yeah. Well, it cannot be overstated how fast this thing is moving, how pervasive. There is not a single mainstream institution today, whether it's in academia or the corporate world or scientific laboratories, that is not fanatically obsessed with racial and gender bean counting, and that is not lowering standards in order to engineer race and gender proportionality. This is extraordinarily dangerous. It is putting our competitive edge at risk. And what is so bizarre about it is, as you say, it is both impervious to logical contradiction, but it is also impervious to easily observable facts.
When I was in graduate school in the 80s, I saw identity politics coming in very strongly into the humanities. You were at Yale a few years before, I believe. And I went in, and the humanities to me were about studying the masterpieces, learning my history, getting my philosophical ideas. And so I saw the growth of sexuality studies, for instance, as just this kind of, and I was a big liberal, so I wasn't opposing it, but I just thought it was just kind of this little niche thing that appealed to a very specialized population, that nobody would pay any attention to this, and that the humanities would go on. I mean, how naive was I?
Pretty naive, yeah, and an optimist. I have to say I'm a pessimist by nature. I think these things are sort of genetic, so I may be blind to a lot of things that are improving in my inclination to sort of be somewhat dark in my outlook. But I don't know. I was in school way before you were, Mark, in the 70s. And however much the study of literature was being taken over by high theory, something that I was too naive to oppose, so that I was completely involved in deconstruction. Nevertheless, I feel extraordinarily fortunate to have been studying literature in the 70s because feminism and multiculturalism had not hit. So I had the great privilege to be able to read English literature without any concern for the fact that I was reading dead white males. The question, remarkably, simply never came up. But when I saw this happening in the 80s, of the grotesque protest against Stanford's very modest core curriculum distributions led by Jesse Jackson with the chant, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, Western Civ has got to go," to me that signaled something extraordinarily dangerous, and I didn't think there was any going back to a non-gender, non-race, non-hostility-infused study of great works.
But you left academia before then, correct?
I came back to start a PhD in comparative literature in 1980 back at Yale, having studied linguistics at Cambridge University, which was my lifeline in a sense, because it allowed me to understand that the deconstructive theory that I had so uncritically absorbed as the definitive statement about language while I was an undergraduate was in fact lunacy, and very bizarre and perverse lunacy at that. So when I went back to Yale and started up that same study under the same professors, rather than adulating them, I looked on them with dismay and just amazement that they could be mouthing these patent untruths again and again. But even then, in 1980, I don't recall, I mean, Paul de Man read Proust, he read Shelley. he read Kleist, and his concern, I mean, the great irony is deconstruction, one of its most bizarre tenets was that there was no such thing as the human self. The self was merely a epiphenomenon of language, was a mere rhetorical trope. Well, the great irony of intellectual history is deconstruction set in play a set of bizarre rhetoric about différence and language. The self came roaring back with a vengeance. Now, the only thing that people want to study is themselves in the most narrow, narcissistic way.
That is, you know, something no one's ever quite put it that clearly. That is an irony that is extraordinary. How identity came back, with a vengeance against the dismantling process. Maybe the dismantling of what the romantic self opened the way for a political self somehow. I don't know. One thing you do bring out in the book on the delusional side is a kind of psychopathological theme. You refer to the hysterical campus. You talk about the fainting couch at Columbia. When you go through your premises of the delusion, you call them charged ideas, as if there is some kind of psychological or neurotic charge. Do you find that the people in charge, or maybe the institution as a whole, is kind of in a collective neurosis?
Yes. Oh,
right,
absolutely. There is a hysteria on college campuses. It's perpetrated by the adults. It's encouraged by the adults. And again, it is a patent delusion to think that any American college student today is at risk of his life from circumambient racism and sexism. And yet that is the conceit that is drummed into students' heads from the moment they step on campus. They are taught to think of themselves in binary categories. They're either the oppressed or the oppressors. The only way that the oppressed, which is quintessentially white, male, heterosexual, now we have cisnormative, which means you identify as your biological sex. The only way to claw your way out of that pariah oppressor status is by declaring yourself a, quote, ally, an ally of the oppressed. Allies are something we usually have in war, but the idea is that American college campuses are literally waging war against females and students of color. This is patently delusional because there is not a single faculty hiring search today that is not one desperate effort to find remotely qualified females and blacks and Hispanics to hire. There's not a single selective college today that is not employing vast and extraordinarily destructive racial preferences in order to admit as many underqualified black and Hispanic students as possible. So to have both the adults on campuses and students saying that they're in a racist and sexist environment is, again, a patent delusion, and yet that is the reigning ideology.
And I think the psychological language, the pathologic, is correct, because if you've been there and seen, listened to people in the grip of this right in front of you, it can be striking. Because last year I gave a talk at Wesleyan, and I talked about Donald Trump. Trump is a sort of rogue American outlaw figure with a long tradition. I was trying to frame him that way, and some students were very upset. Some of them stormed out and slammed the door. But afterwards, a few came up, and they talked to me. It was actually a pretty good exchange. But one says, "Listen, you've got to see. These people are afraid. They are in fear of their very existence." And I looked into this student's face, and I thought, I can't attach your words to any reality I have ever seen on a college campus. But it was right there.
Yep.
It was fervent and ardent, and earnest and sincere. And I thought, where is this coming from? What is going on here? You had actually one of the notorious episodes that happened at campus episodes that happened at Claremont, and you talk about it in the book. What happened at Claremont?
Well, I had been invited by a academic center there to give a talk on my previous book, The War on Cops, which argues that the Black Lives Matter narrative that we are living through endemic, epidemic of racially biased police shootings of black men, and that policing is endemically racist, that Black Lives Matter narrative is false. And I document the considerable support for the police in high crime minority neighborhoods. That was a message that the students at the Claremont colleges, not just Claremont McKenna, which had invited me, but Pomona, Scripps, Harvey Mudd, others, other of the nearby Claremont colleges, believed was also going to be lethal to their very existence. And so a call went out on Facebook a few days before my talk to shut the racist, homophobic, queerphobe, Islamophobe Heather McDonald down.
Oh, I read some of the descriptions of you. Just the lunatic.
Lunatic, right.
Is the only word
yeah.
to describe what they said.
And so on the day itself, the students blockaded the auditorium where I was supposed to be giving my talk, preceded by a dinner with students so that there could be a informal discussion beforehand. Nearly 300 students. The police, of course, were utterly feckless, as is the case in the Black Lives Matter moment that we live. And I think the university administration had also said, do not dare put a hand on students, because everybody's terrified now to have police officers use lawful force, however justified. So the students took over and they prevented anybody from coming in to hear my talk. So I gave it to an empty room, and then the students were outside banging on the plate glass windows, drumming and shouting, and at some point the police decided it was no longer safe to be inside, and I was escorted through the kitchen into a waiting police van and taken to the Claremont City Police Department for my getaway. But
this is unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, what I said, you know, I hope as you've been chanting here for the last 3 hours, that you've also chanted against the killers of Aaron Shannon Jr., a 5-year-old boy who was fatally shot in South Central Los Angeles wearing his Spider-Man costume on Halloween by gangbangers, by Kitchen Crips gangbangers. If you really care about Black Lives Mattering, you know, why don't you ever talk about the black-on-black ghetto violence that is mowing down black children at a rate that would cause a national revolution if white kids were being mowed down at that rate?
Sometimes I wonder if the response against cops is really some kind of displaced defense mechanism of rage against what is happening. They simply can't turn around and blame the victim. You know, blame the victim on the community level, but they have to find someone. They can't contain the dismay and the shock of the crime, the violence that you find in so many African-American communities, the fatherlessness. One of the things you brought out in the War on Cops book is how many of these young perpetrators and the gang kids have no fathers in the home. And that's not going to get better anytime soon.
Well, I would agree, except to the extent that your question mark presupposes knowledge about the degree of black crime. And these are uncomfortable topics to speak about, and in part because the media elites have done such a good job of keeping people in ignorance.
And the kids who
are
go to
ignorant.
Claremont,
they don't have a clue.
They don't come out of those neighborhoods.
Right.
So they don't know.
And
the African-American kids, or these are suburban,
right,
upper middle class kids, so they have no exposure.
Absolutely.
Except what they hear in the press, which is always the cops.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the only killings of blacks that really gets ever any national coverage or even local coverage is if a cop, which is a minute, you know, the cops could end all fatal shootings tomorrow and it would have a negligible effect on the black death by homicide rate.
Right, right. You know, you said they made it seem as if your words were lethal to them, and it recalled, I was thinking, how in the world did words, did we lose sticks and stones? And, you know, when Toni Morrison says in her 1993 Nobel Prize for Literature speech, oppressive language doesn't just represent violence, it is violence. She said, that's word for word. What she says, language is violence. Well, if you're teaching that, I mean, if you are pounding it in, you know, words can hurt. We can hurt our feelings, but you can certainly, when you get kids young and you can start telling them that when your feelings are hurt, violence has been done to you. And these kids are in the selective schools, a hyper-competitive environment, right? And the school officials, they want happy faces on the news. They promised these kids, this is the greatest campus. This is a wonderful, inclusive, tolerant place. You're going to thrive here. And then they come in, the realities of these selective campuses are they are ruthlessly competitive places. And the things aren't going well for the kids. And they've got to find something, an out. They've got to find the kids who are admitted by affirmative action, who are smart kids, but they're in organic chemistry. They want to be pre-med, and they're in organic chemistry with these super, super smart Asians and whites, and it doesn't go well for them.
Well, I think you've put your finger on what really is driving a massive amount of the diversity madness, which is racial preferences. And it is the most depressing, vicious cycle. As you say, because of racial preferences, blacks and to a slightly lesser extent, Hispanics are catapulted into environments for which they are not prepared to compete. It's not to say that those preference beneficiaries could not succeed in schools where they simply matched the academic qualifications of their peers. Like every other whites and Hispanics go to schools where their white and Hispanic peers are by and large in their same academic preparedness level. Only blacks and Hispanics are put at this enormous handicap of being catapulted a standard deviation or two above where they're prepared as freshmen to start from. And so those students have two alternatives. They can say, I have been admitted under racial preferences into an environment for which I'm not prepared, or I'm in an environment of microaggressions, systemic bias, and hate speech, and that's why I'm feeling uncomfortable, that's why I'm not being chosen first for study groups, that's why I'm clustering in the Black Studies Center so I can feel safe. And not surprisingly, most students choose the second explanation. I disagree with something that you said earlier, Mark, however, which is that the adults want to see happy faces. I suppose they do for their publicity stills, but there is now an entire bureaucracy that does not want to see happy faces. It wants to see screaming faces. It wants to see protesting faces. It wants to see oppressed faces. And these diversity bureaucrats look no further for the why we have obscenely expensive tuition than the metastasizing diversity bureaucracy at UCLA, a public university, University of California, Los Angeles. The diversity vice chancellor there is paid over $400,000 a year. That's a sum that could support several junior faculty, free tuition for dozens of students. These diversity bureaucrats that are at every mainstream institution now are committed to teaching students to think of themselves as victims and oppressed. The role of adults on a college campus should be to teach children, which I regard college students as still children, to understand the difference between real and phantom problems. Being asked, so like, what are you? In a world that treats ethnic identity as the most important thing about the self, is not a real problem. It's a phantom problem. It gets labeled as a microaggression by students. Microaggressions are an implicit acknowledgement that racism has virtually disappeared from college campuses, and we are forced instead to be on the lookout for invisible racism, which is another word for microaggressions. Another microaggression is, I don't see your color, I only see you as a person. Well, I thought that was a good thing. I thought
Martin Luther King
exactly. said. No, that's a microaggression. Again, this is where I spoke at the beginning of the bizarre mutual contradiction of the categories that on the one hand we're told that race is a social construct. So if you say, I don't see your race, I see you as a person, that should be good. But if you say that, you're told that you have now disrespected that person because race is the most important thing about him. It's, in other words, essential. It's not a social construct. So it's very hard to know what side of the bed to get out of every morning.
It really keeps people who are not members of the disadvantaged minority off balance.
Right, they're on their toes all the time. Right.
You gotta be careful, and I think that's part of the point.
Right.
You know, that's what a diversocrat never wants you to feel too comfortable in what you believe.
You know, right, and we may, the people that don't get to count as either ally or the oppressed, and I guess as a female I should be just seizing on my wonderful oppressed category, but I do not. I refuse to think of myself as oppressed. I've never been discriminated against in my life as a female. To the contrary, I have been the undoubted subject of gender preferences all my life. But we who are not in the oppressed category may feel sort of at odds or not certain of our terrain. But let's not forget that those in the highly status-filled victim category also are always struggling, because the totem pole of victimhood is ruthlessly competitive. Groups are pulling each other down all the time. It's a ruthless struggle for ascendancy. The concept of intersectionality has been blown up in recent decades to try and provide extra brownie victim points to different categories. And I think we should have a sort of GoFundMe crowdsourcing betting initiative, or we could use a betting pool to determine who is going to pull the trans group down from their current top dog status on the ruthlessly competitive totem pole of victimhood, because they have now displaced females, they've displaced blacks and Hispanics, they've displaced gays, but their position is not certain, it's not eternal. Within the next 5 years, at least, if not sooner, another group will displace trans. I do not have the clairvoyance to see what's coming, but it is coming. And maybe First Things can do a sweepstakes to see who can guess.
I was, you know, we're over now, but I wanna ask you one more thing, because the future question: how long can this delusion? How long can this go?
It can go as long as the rest of us do not start telling the truth, which is the explanation for the lack of proportionality in institutions is not racism and sexism. It's skills, aptitudes, preferences, culture, and behavior. When it comes to racial proportionality, I have a thought experiment in the book. I say, if blacks acted like Asians for 10 years with regards to family formation, not having children out of wedlock, studying fanatically, not dropping out of school, going to class, taking your textbooks home, not joining gangs, not getting involved in drugs. If blacks acted like Asians in all things with a fanatical academic culture, and we still saw racial disparities after 10 years, then I will entertain the explanation that America is, as Ta-Nehisi Coates says, endemically and constitutionally racist. But at present, with the behavioral disparities as glaring as they are, with the academic achievement disparities as glaring as they are, it is wildly premature to say that racism is the only possible explanation for socioeconomic disparities.
Heather McDonald, thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark. Great talking to you.